Hi, welcome to the Enthusiastic Cast, the web show with two guys where we talk about mostly books. I'm Mark, he's John. Today we're going to be enthusiastic about Lauren Hillenbrand's The Unbroken. But first, John, it's hot out there, it's summertime, it's good stuff. There's summer movies on the way. One of the summer movies that's coming up is Ender's Game. We're talking about a military story from World War II to a certain degree. And that sent me down kind of I've been down a bit of a military sci-fi rabbit hole of recent. And I know that you're kind of more well-read in that genre than I am. So I'm playing catch-up. And we've talked about this offline. And I just want to ask you, so military sci-fi, not a lot to recommend it from the outside, just like guns in space. But I have uncovered all kinds of value there. If you were to recommend to someone that's not familiar with the genre to get into it, why would you say give it a go?
I think you do sort of have to have an interest to a certain degree in science fiction and in military stories. I think if you don't have any interest in those two things, I think if you've tried science fiction in the past and you don't like it, this is not, you know, some special flavor of science fiction that's going to cut through that and suddenly be wonderful for you. And similarly, if you're not interested in military stories to any degree, this is not going to work for you. But putting that, if you do have even the smallest interest in those things, though, there's a lot of different flavors of it in military science fiction. You're going to, looking at what I've read, and you say that I'm better read than you, and I don't know if that's actually true anymore, because just from our conversations offline, I think you've caught up and surpassed me in terms of the breadth of what you've read. But it covers a lot of different grounds. You're going to get a lot of different types of stories within this genre, and basically, subgenre. And just quickly to define the subgenre, it's what you said. It's guns in space, right? It's usually off Earth, although that's not 100% true. And it specifically deals with the adventures or the activities of the military in some kind of science fiction setting. So rather than dealing with, you know, Jedi Knights or space pirates or aliens or the government or scientists or time travelers or whatever, you're dealing with, okay, it's a science fiction setting. What's the army doing? But then once you get that basic setup, you can go a lot of different ways with it, just as you can go a lot of different ways with any military story, right? You can valorize it, you can criticize it, you can satirize it, you can do lots of things. And because you're in a science fiction setting, you kind of have you have more tools in your toolbox. There's a little bit, you know, a little bit more leeway with what you can do and ways that you can play it. So what have to cover off what you've read, what have you been reading recently in your little sort of, you know, round the world tour?
So I didn't set out to read military sci-fi in itself. Like I started with a recommendation from the show that you did, which was The Old Man's War, and you were just like, yeah, pretty good. And so I checked that out, and then as things happen, one thing leads to another. And one of the themes of the Old Man's War, and I don't know if you talked about this on the show or not, but it's the time distillation, when you go travel in space and go, you know, close to the speed of light and then return, time moves at a different speed on Earth than for you. So it's really like, it's really a story of a man right out of time. And that actually is a sub-genre of military sci-fi, because there's several stories that that touch on that or have that as a theme. So I've done a bunch of Wikipedia searching and looking online, and like, if you want lists of sci-fi, you know, military sci-fi. There are lists on the internet, let me tell you.
Oh yeah.
And so I was like, oh, everyone's like really jazzed about Armor, the Strachley, I believe. Is that how you say his last name?
It's either Steakley or Stakely, but I figure if you have steak in your name, then you should go with steak. And he, I was sad to learn, because I was looking this up, he passed away in 2010. He published two novels, Armor and Vampires, the S in Vampires being a dollar sign, which was made into a movie with James Woods back in the 90s. And those were the only two novels that he ever published. And there was a long-promised sequel to Armor that he was supposedly working on forever and forever and forever and forever, and he never finished it. And then now, unfortunately, he's gone.
Well, the internet fanboys are ramped about that book. You said it was great, so I was like, oh, yeah, bring it on.
Yeah, I mentioned that when we talked about movies, books that had not been turned into movies, but that we'd love to see turned into movies. That was one of mine.
Right. So I'm looking to go up the ladder from sub-genre to sub-genre and explore this some more. Like, I read Star Trek Troopers when I was in school.
Right.
And didn't particularly love it, but
no.
Kind of was like, oh, okay, you know, I get it. And then, of course, I was all over Ender's Game here on the show.
Yep.
So I'm looking for what else is out there, and I'm keen to be enthusiastic about stuff on the horizon.
So out of all this, there was a couple of things that I wanted to talk about this genre, as you mentioned. So there's this theme of time dilation, right? That, you know, one of the science fiction tropes is that they're traveling at light speed and or close to light speed, and that's, you know, basically as soon as they leave for the war, that they're never coming back, or at least they're never coming back to what they left behind. And I think thematically that's really, really interesting, and a really interesting way of dealing with the experience of going to war, right? And that notion that, you know, you can never put your hand in the same river twice, and that you go to war and you come back a different person. And because you're a different person, the world that you're in is different. And, you know, of course, PTSD and, you know, the long-term effects of being in combat after the combat is over are a huge part of what we talk about now when we talk about the military. And I think that's one way that science fiction kind of deals with that, or kind of turns that into text. The other thing that I was interested in, and so you mentioned Starship Troopers, and you mentioned the book Armor, and the book Armor is called Armor because the main combatants, the main soldiers, wear these nuclear-powered suits of armor that turn them kind of, you know, each soldier is a sort of a tank unto himself or herself. And so that's something which part of it is, you know, Heinlein did it in Starship Troopers and people loved it. And so people have, you know, homaged that and redone that in their own versions, kind of in the same way that so much fantasy owes has so many homages to Lord of the Rings. And if you ask somebody, well, why did you put elves in your book, and it's like, well, because it's a fantasy novel and you always put elves in your book, right? Like, there's no greater purpose to it than that. But also something that I remember from Old Man's War, and we saw this again in The Forever War by Joe Haldeman, and I think it was in and it probably wasn't in Starship Troopers, because I remember that was one of Heinlein's juveniles, which was written for a younger audience, so it probably didn't get too sexy. But there's one of the elements of the subgenre is that in these sort of future militaries, there's a sexual egalitarianism, right? And so I would be really curious. I couldn't find any writing on the subject, but I'm really interested in what a female perspective on this subgenre is, because it seems like a lot of effort is made to completely erase gender distinctions, right? So you get into the military and all romance is removed from sex. So you're, you know, everybody's at sexual parity with one another. And then you get into these powered suits, these armored suits, which, you know, erase any, genetic advantages of one gender or the other, right? And it comes up again and again and again. And yet one of my only complaint about Armor, which I think is one of my favorite books, is the older I get, and I've read it a couple of times now, and I find its attitude towards women to be kind of problematic. It's great in so many regards, in terms of an adventure story, in terms of an examination of war, in terms of an examination of heroism and self-sacrifice. And yet it's got this blind spot where there's a borderline misogynistic attitude towards women. I think it's aiming for kind of a noir thing, and it just misses the mark. But that could be that I've got rose-colored glasses on a little bit. It might be better than I think. It might be worse than I think. I really have difficulty calling the ball on that one at this point. But I was wondering if you noticed anything, about specific to gender roles while you were going through all these books.
Well, I think that's actually in Star Trek Troopers, to be honest, or maybe I'm just remembering it from the movie. But
the movie definitely. But
they're all bumping uglies, like after the big war, right?
Right.
Or after the big battle. Yeah. Well, a lot of the stuff. Well, not the Scalzi, but the other stuff was written in the 70s as kind of a reaction to Vietnam, right? So I. Yeah, there's a lot that's kind of tin-eared about it, but it's just like, okay, so are you just not giving a crap, or are you being provocative, or does this just not read well 25 years later?
Right. Is it more to do with the fact that this is post-sexual revolution, or and less to do with gender redefinition? When these books were written, one of the things that we talked about the Forever War offline was how well does it age, right? Because, of course, it was written in 1974. It's a novel. It's a Vietnam-era book. Obviously, actual technology has moved on a lot in the intervening nearly 40 years. So there's stuff there that's kind of weird. There's certain attitudes that parse, better or worse 40 years later, but it's still really relevant as a book about war, and it has its own attitudes about the purpose, the nature, and the validity of war. But it also serves as kind of a time capsule, right? Like, this is, even though it's a science fiction novel, even though it's set in the future, in the very far future, it's kind of a time capsule about, well, this is what people were thinking about in 1974, right? This is what they were concerned about. This is their general sentiment about, military adventurism, all of that. And you can kind of say the same thing about, you can definitely say the same thing about Starship Troopers, which is from, 1959. And it is, you said it when you were talking about Ender's Game and you were referencing Starship Troopers. It's a bit of a polemic, right? Like, it wears its intentions on its sleeve, and basically it's Heinlein saying, the army is great, being a soldier is great, and there's the valorization of, the poor damn infantry. And then, going forward, though, I start to wonder about what the later military sci-fi novels are saying about the attitudes towards the military in their particular times. So you've got Ender's Game and Armor, which are 1984, 1985. And then, skipping ahead another 20 years, you've got Old Man's War, which is a recent novel. It's a post 9/11 novel. And then you've got something like All You Need Is Kill by Hiroshi Sakurazaka, a Japanese author. And that's 2004. And I'm looking at those books and I'm looking for, a post 9/11 sense of how the military operates and, what it means to be to be part of a military campaign. And they're very different books, but I couldn't relate either of those books to their moment. And maybe I'm missing something. Maybe they are saying something. And you read Old Man's War more recently than I did. Was there anything there which you think was specific to this moment in 40 years? Is somebody going to go back and read Old Man's War and go, oh, I can see what Scalzi was concerned with because this is when the U.S. was in Afghanistan and they were in Iraq and, you know, all this was going on and he's dealing with it there? Or is it just completely divorced from that? Is it a completely, at that point, is the subgenre well established enough that it can exist independent of its time?
I don't know. Like when I read The Old Man's War, I was just thinking, oh, you kind of need to be an old man yourself to write like this, right? Because it's really a middle-aged man's fantasy of not dying.
Yes.
And so I wasn't, you know, it's got the elements of the genre or the subgenre and it's got its touchstones and all of that stuff, but my primary takeaway was like, oh, this really isn't about, you know, this really isn't about current affairs or about the military at all. This is really about being old.
Right.
Anyway, speaking of, well, yeah, what you were talking about, Heinlein writing in 1959, The Greatest Generation. Louis Zamperini is clearly a member of The Greatest Generation. He had a military experience unlike anyone in Vietnam, I'm sure. Or maybe not. Who knows? But the 2010 Lauren Hillenbrand book, The Unbroken, is the story of Louis Zamperini. Set it up for us.
Okay, so this is actually, you know, this is the Enthusiasticast version 1.0, because you mentioned this book to me. We saw each other offline. You mentioned that you were reading it. You were so glowing about it. You weren't even finished it at that time. You were so glowing about it that I was like, okay, I'm going to read that. And I picked it up and read it, and I was blown away. So came out in 2010. Its author is Laura Hillenbrand, who wrote Seabiscuit and American Legend, which was turned into the movie with Tobey Maguire. And this is her first book since that book. She, I think it was 10 years in between those two, maybe even longer. And I'll get into why that is later. And so this book is about somebody that she discovered, or not that she discovered, because actually this is apparently the fourth book about Louis Zamperini, but this is the one that really broke through and caught the public imagination and became a huge bestseller. And she became aware of him when she was doing all this research for Seabiscuit, because Louis Zamperini and Seabiscuit were famous around the same time. And so she would often see his name mentioned in the newspapers of the time on the sports pages. There'd be articles about Seabiscuit, and then there'd be articles about him because he was an Olympic runner. And he went to the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, and he was, you know, for a long time by a lot of people, he was considered the guy most likely to break the 4-minute mile, which was the barrier at that time. And the reason why he wasn't that guy, it kind of forms the crux of this novel. So it's a nonfiction story, obviously, and it covers his life, focusing on the most interesting parts of his life, of which there are many, and they go on for a great number of years. It starts with kind of his rough and tumble childhood, and then how he took some of his overabundance of energy, which had turned to, you know, delinquency and what have you, at a young age, and turned that into athletic energy and became a world-class winning, record-breaking Olympic runner. And then, of course, the Second World War happened, and he signed up and became a B-24 bomber in the Army Air Services. So not the Air Force, but the air services portion of the army. And he went to war in the Pacific theater in the conflict with Japan. And in thinking about how I was going to be enthusiastic about this book, I didn't know how much to say about what happens in the book. I think most of that is on the jacket copy. And then, so I will say that the cover of the book has a picture of the ocean on it. And the reason for that is that his bomber goes down and he is lost at sea with several other crewmen who also survived the crash. And they are at sea for a very long time. And it is, you know, it is a human ordeal, the likes of which I have rarely heard about or read about. And then it goes on from there. I had the interesting experience of reading them. Well, not that interesting, but it worked interestingly with the text. I read it digitally, and it was very difficult because I knew that there was a huge appendices, and I read it on my phone. So everything, you know, it was like tiny chunks of information. And I knew there was a huge appendices to it with obviously all the citations and what have you. And so I didn't know how much was left of the book at any point while I was reading it. And so I had sort of a false perception about where I was in his story for most of it, because it kept surprising me how
it's
much.
It's like he goes to the Olympics and then that's it.
That could have been it, honestly.
No, well, totally. It's just like I've read biographies of lesser accomplishments, right?
Absolutely. You like just this guy who has a hard scrabble youth and, you know, grows up to go to the Olympics. That's a movie. And that's like the first, I don't know, 15 pages.
Oh man! So it's like, what a talent Lauren Hellenbrand is, right?
Oh,
like,
my gosh,
amazing!
She's amazing.
So when it starts off with like the hard scrabble life, and he's like the Italian immigrant and all that, I was like kind of rolling my eyes. But then like 4 pages later, I was like, I'm clearly in the hands of a very experienced storyteller. So I'm just gonna sit back and let this go.
She is amazing. Like one of the issues with nonfiction, it seems to me there's two big issues that come up in a lot of the nonfiction that I read. And the first of all is things that the writer can't know, and it's impossible for them to find out.
Do you want to talk about this right now? Because I want to dig into this a little bit later, but I'm worried about spoilers.
Right. Okay.
So do you want to, so you were like, oh, we'll talk about Lauren Hellenbrand later. So she's a shut-in, right? That's why there's a 10-year break here.
Yes, because she has chronic fatigue syndrome, which developed when she was 19. And so she's had it for about 30 years now. And yeah, she doesn't leave the house. She has a house in Washington. And the reason that she has a house in Washington is basically she got there at some point for some reason and then didn't have the energy to go anywhere else. Like, she lives in Washington kind of by default. That was where she was when she fell down and couldn't get up again. I'm being glib about that, and I don't mean to be, but I just find that incredible. And her husband finished school and came to join her, and they've, you know, built a life. And it's phenomenal just in reading about her, what her life is like. Like, a big outing for her was she and her husband got in the car and drove to the parking lot of a Starbucks, sat there for a little bit, and then drove home. Like, 'cause she had just enough energy to get from the house to the car. And then, I don't know, maybe he carried her back in. But she has, like, enough energy for one thing a day.
Which makes the narrative of the story both touching, because obviously it's a story of endurance and of overcoming physical barriers.
Right. Well, she said as much, right? People have said, like, is this, you know, how does this relate to your condition and your life? You know, you write about these feats of huge endurance, you know, first with Seabiscuit and then with Zamperini. And she's like, absolutely. I'm living vicariously through these amazing achievements of, you know, human endurance, because I myself have none.
So, and as you know, as people that may or may not have listened to the show know, like, this is right up my alley, right? Like, this is totally in my wheelhouse. I love Ben McIntyre. Ben McIntyre wrote Agent Zigzag, which I recommended on the show before. I've read his other stuff. He goes back to the very, you know, edges of human memory and claws back these masterful stories. And it's just, like, awesome, awesome, awesome. I also recommended on the show Wilbert Rito's story of being in Angola prison. Yep. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
Yeah. So, and that was like, oh, this is like Shawshank in real life. Oh my God. Amazing, right? And the critics of Wilbert Rito and the critics of that book were just like, yeah, but he he's an unreliable narrator. He is a crook. He's a criminal. He's a murderer. This is not something you want to get behind because he is a self-promoter, right?
Right.
So you were touching on the problems of nonfiction. Did you ever feel like this story was too good to be true? Either that Louis Zamperini, you know, had rehearsed this thing, right?
No.
To the point where... Or did you ever feel manipulated by Hillenbrand?
Yes, yes and no. I think to a certain extent, obviously, there's going to be manipulation. But she did certain things. So the two problems of nonfiction that I that crop up again and again, right, are one, the things that the writer can't know and wishes they did know. Because, you know, there's a gap there, right? There's something that needs explanation. No explanation is forthcoming. And the other thing is, obviously, you know, when the facts of real life go in a way that the author wishes that they didn't. Because it would be a much neater, tidier, maybe more compelling narrative if, you know, they zigged, but instead they zagged. Because real life doesn't work in a three-act structure. And so... obviously, that comes up in this story. You come up against gaps in what is knowable. And then you come up with places in the story where it would be more neat and tidy. And, you know, probably in the movie version, they're going to change some of these things for it to go a certain way. And it doesn't go that way, right? And I guess the thing that gave me confidence in the narrative is the fact that Hillenbrand addresses those things, right? She doesn't dwell on them. She's a good enough storyteller that she shapes the reading experience in such a way that there's a consistency and that the pacing always works. But at the same time, she doesn't gloss over some of the things that obviously, as a reader, you can see, wow, it would have been easier to leave that out, or it would have been easier to try and paint that a certain way, or it would have been easier to try and pretend that you knew something, to insert a bit of editorializing there, or to insert a bit of fiction there, and she doesn't, and she does it obviously enough. That's what was masterful to me was. She shows her hand, but not in a way that that felt clunky, but actually in a way that only built my confidence. And it's interesting, in an interview that I read with Louis Zamperini, he said, basically, when I need to remember something about that time, I actually talk to her now rather than consult my own memories, because he would tell her things and then she would go away and check on them. Right. And she would get corroborating information and she would talk to other people and she would get documentation and whatnot. So she wasn't just relying on his memory. And in fact, you know, she was fact checking him, which I think you can really see in the narrative.
Right. And well, and she wears her politics on her sleeve. Right. So in some of the darker moments, she's just like, yeah, I'm just going to call this for what it is. And like, this is how this went down. And, you know, for people reading in the 21st century, here's a touchstone to what that experience might have been like. Right.
Yep.
And she totally foregrounds that, does not back away from it. But not, you're right. She doesn't dwell on it either. And so it's just like, oh, respect. Amazing.
Ah, so good. They never even met. They never even met while she was doing all this. Because obviously she's homebound. And he didn't know. He didn't know until he read an article about her that she was going through all this. And he then sent her one of his Purple Hearts.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Right?
Because... And has actually said, he's like, yeah, I went through hell, but it was only a couple of years. You know, she's been going through hell for 30 years. And I'm like, yeah, I read your book, man. Like, don't sell yourself short. Speaking of, and did you see that they're moving ahead with the movie version of this book?
Well, yeah, so when I read it or whatever, I looked into, I looked into the internet gossip at the time and Angelina Jolie was attached at that time. I don't know if she still is or what's going on.
She's
going
to be directing it, and they've just cast the lead. they've just cast him. It's some young actor named Jack O'Connell, who I've never heard of or seen before. So that's great, because I would, in a thing like this, I would much prefer an unknown. You know, I don't want whoever. Andrew Garfield as Louis Zamperini. As much as I like Andrew Garfield as an actor, it's going to be distracting.
I thought it would be one of the Douglas children.
No.
Okay, so why don't we end it there? This has been The Enthusiasticast, our discussion of Lauren Hillenbrand's The Unbroken. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark.
I'm John.
Talk to you next time.
Cheers. Okay, so now you have to go back and edit all the times that you said Lauren instead of Laura.
Yes. Fuck.